kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Good morning, Vietnam, and good timely greeting to you, listener. Welcome back to yet another exciting installment in our special Marvel series. As we continue to progress our way through phase one, we find ourselves at a Marvel film that holds a very special place in my heart. And if you've listened to any of my previous episodes, you probably have a good theory as to why that is the case. But it's not just the fact that Natalie Portman stars in Thor that makes it so special to me. Thor has always been one of my very favorite members of the Avengers. I love Chris Hemsworth's portrayal of him specifically, and I absolutely love Kenneth Branagh's direction of this first Thor installment. So for those reasons, and of course because Natalie Portman is in it, it is one of my absolute favorite Marvel films. I think that it doesn't get the credit that it so rightfully deserves as a phenomenal origins film, and an origins film with a very specific creative and artistic vision, which of course comes from Kenneth Branagh, who is a genius in the director's chair, and I think that he is criminally underrated as a director in the modern cinema canon. So I hope that you guys enjoy Thor. I don't know why you're here if you don't. Maybe you're just a Marvel fan and Thor's not your absolute favorite, but hopefully by the end of this conversation, I will be able to convert you if you are not a huge Thor fan. But I mean, come on, who doesn't love Thor? I'm very excited for the conversation we're going to have today, and I think that Hagen's going to have some interesting points, and hopefully he's going to keep me in check so that I don't just spend the next however long this conversation ends up being gushing about this film. But there's a very good chance I might do that. So hopefully Hagen holds me in check. We'll have to wait and see. But I hope that you're ready to dive into discussion on 2011's Thor. Without further ado, let's get started.
You are a vain, greedy, cruel boy. And you are an old man and a fool.
You're unworthy.
Father.
I now take from you your power. I cast you out!
Please, open your eyes.
Oh, no, this is Earth, isn't it?
Where'd it come from?
Your ancestors called it magic. And you call it science. I come from a place where they're one and the same.
He has disobeyed his king. His fate is in his own hands now.
I will end this.
So here today to help me discuss the phenomenal film, Thor, is a very special guest, Hagen. Introduce yourself, Hagen.
Hi, everyone. Hopefully you've heard me on once or twice before. But yeah, I'm here to talk about Thor and to mostly curb Kyla's obsession with Natalie Portman and keep things grounded a little bit today.
Listen, Thor is not the movie where my bias shines through most ardently, okay? I don't need you to curb me here as much as I would on other films.
I just don't want to set a bad precedent and let you go unchecked for the Dark World.
Okay. You're already bringing it up. You just couldn't. We didn't even make it a full minute without you attacking me for the fact that I enjoy the Dark World.
See, you just said enjoy the Dark World.
I do enjoy the Dark World. Please don't turn this episode off if you hate the Dark World. We're not talking about the Dark World today. That's a later episode that Hagen is not invited back for.
Thankfully.
Shut up. Okay. So moving right along, I am going to now have Hagen answer my special 5 standard Marvel Central getting to know you questions. So, Hagen, are you prepared?
I sure hope so.
I hope so, too. You came out of the gate so strong with your anti-Dark World opinions that I'm going to hold you to such a high standard with everything you say from here on out.
Okay.
All right. First question, Hagen. Who is your favorite Avenger?
So for this one, I had to put a little bit of thought into it. But I think I'm just going to go with Tony Stark, Iron Man. You just can't go wrong with that answer. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty solid. I can't fault you for that one. Especially, like, our generation has such a special relationship, I feel like, with Tony Stark, Iron Man, because of Robert Downey Jr. and because of him being the OG Avenger that we saw, like, a Marvel film iteration of.
And right.
So I just feel like...
And he had so much character development compared to all these other Avengers, you know, who kind of just showed up, like, not that they were one-dimensional, but, like, he literally addressed so many things that he also was able to take from his own personal life, you know? And it's just, so, yeah, most character development.
Yeah, definitely. You know, great Avenger. The most dynamic arc across all the films, for sure.
Yeah.
So, Hagen, what is your favorite Marvel movie?
So my favorite is definitely Far From Home. It's just such a good movie. I, like, enjoyed pretty much the entire thing. And, like, of course, you know, like, I mean, yeah, I won't go into it too much, but, like, there's just so many great scenes. I love Tom Holland as Spider-Man. Far From Home, it's great. I love it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good one. I can't roast you.
Okay.
I'm disappointed that I can't roast you.
I think you're going to really attack me for my answer to the next question, though.
Okay, well, I'm literally bracing. You can't see it, but I'm, like, grimacing. Hagen, what do you consider to be the best Marvel movie?
Now, of all the movies I've seen in theaters,
I know what this is about to be.
I think the best Marvel movie that I've seen was Thor Ragnarok.
I knew it. I was hoping I was wrong, but I was right.
You only dislike that answer for, like, personal biases, though. So
I fully agree with what you just said, and that, like, it's fine. I still stand by my opinion.
It's just such a good movie. Such it a is. Good movie.
It is such a good movie. Now I have to explain to everyone my beef with Thor Ragnarok. You did this, Hagen. You caused this. So, my beef with Ragnarok is a nearly perfect Marvel film. It truly, truly is. I am deeply emotionally scarred by the theatrical release of Ragnarok, though, because Taika Waititi tweeted the week before Ragnarok dropped 2 images of Natalie Portman side by side, one from The Professional holding Leon's tree, one from Where the Heart Is holding Novalee's Buckeye tree, and the caption simply read, "Heed the signs." So, 2017-year-old Kyla got it in her head that Natalie Portman was going to cameo in this movie, even though Marvel had made it clear that Natalie Portman had cut her ties with the studio. So I roll up to Thor Ragnarok opening night expecting to see my girl Natalie Portman, wait all the way through the post-credit scene, and she's nowhere to be found, and I am heartbroken. So for that reason, Ragnarok just left me with this gaping wound in my heart. And is it above the Dark World? No comment. I plead the fifth.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, that's what I consider the best Marvel film.
Now
so
you
far.
Can explain why you consider it the best. I'm sorry that I sucked up your airtime.
No, I love the character development between Thor and Loki and the whole, you know, God of Thunder thing. I really like the losing the one eye thing. Like, mm-hmm. I thought that was a very, very nice touch. And then, of course, like, the fight with the Hulk. And like, okay, within the fight with the Hulk, I mean, if this isn't your favorite like moment, then like you're not a real Marvel fan, in my opinion. But like the moment when the Hulk smashes Thor around and then Loki stands up and like just cheers, like, you know, as a throwback to the original Avengers, is like one of the best moments in like any of the movies that they have made.
It is a good moment. It is. Also, I do appreciate the characters that that film introduced. Like, what a great cast. We had Tessa Thompson, we had Cate Blanchett, we had Jeff Goldblum. Like, it is a phenomenal installment in the MCU.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
But it just... I'm still recovering. Okay. Moving on. Hagen, what do you consider to be the best Marvel costume?
I thought that was the last question. I haven't decided yet. Best Marvel costume. I am not like really attached to anything here, so I'm just gonna go with Spider-Man suit in Far From Home, purely because of the emotional attachment to like seeing him create it the way like Tony Stark made his suits. So that is my answer.
It's a good answer. And Spider-Man suit, like, no matter which iteration it is always going to rank really highly for me, because I just have such an attachment to the character of Spider-Man. And like, I like his suit design. I do.
Yeah.
Okay. And final Marvel getting to know you question, Hagen. If you could have one hero's powers, whose would you choose and why?
I would pick Doctor Strange's powers.
Ooh. Interesting.
Yeah. And as like a quick aside for all you listeners out there, we were talking before we started recording about how there's like definitely some like incorrect answers. So I'm just going to defend as to why I think this is not an incorrect answer.
I don't think it's an incorrect answer. I'll
okay.
go
Okay. Well, I'm going to still just continue along that. Whether or not we're including like having the time stone as like part of his powers or not is like a whole other thing, but just, I don't even know where to start, but he's just such a unique character, and that like I kind of see him as a different side of like the Tony Stark coin, and I really like the way they played his character, and then the powers he has, like he uses his head along with his powers in a way that a lot of other characters don't. And so he both outsmarts people and like outpowers them and just like defeats them in the most like efficient ways possible. And you never really see him lose to anyone. He just gives up. So yeah.
All right. I again am disappointed that I cannot roast you for your response, because it's a valid one. It really
Who
is.
Who did you expect I would pick?
I didn't know. I genuinely didn't know. But I knew you weren't going to pick a bad one, because like I know the way your brain works in terms of powers. And so I already know my answer to this question, but I'm not going to give it. I'm saving it for our final episode in our Marvel month. But you guys should all be very excited to hear Hagen turn these questions around on me in the near future.
I'm very excited to do that myself.
So you have my full permission that if my answers are bad, you can roast them.
Oh, I'm prepared to.
When I give The Dark World as the best Marvel movie. That's not going to happen, listeners. I'm sorry. Like, that was a bad joke. So now I'm going to offer some behind-the-scenes fun facts about the making of this film before we dive into our discussion. I'm really excited about these fun facts. Hagen made me feel like such a nerd when we were going over the outline of the show before beginning recording, when I was like, yeah, I got all these fun facts from listening to the commentary. And he was like, what? He was like, they do those? And I was like, yeah, you've never listened to them? Like, Sir Kenneth Branagh tells you everything. And he's like, what's wrong with you? So all that to say,
Even know you could watch movies with commentary.
Your world will be so expanded once you begin to do so, Hagen. Like, you'll learn so much. I'll after we get done recording, I'll recommend to you some of the best film commentaries.
Okay.
But I got a lot of these fun facts from listening to the commentary on this film, and I swear this is going to be my last mention of the Dark World for a long time. But I do want to go ahead and plug the fact that this film has a very interesting commentary, but it's just Sir Kenneth Branagh. The Dark World has a commentary with director Alan Taylor, Marvel head Kevin Feige, Tom Hiddleston, amongst a few others. So, like, the Thor movies have really good commentaries, and everyone should check them out. I don't remember if Ragnarok has a commentary. I need to look into that. I'll pull out my DVD at some point and figure that out. So my first fun fact that Sir Kenneth Branagh gave to me in the commentary is that the town within which the action from this film, which takes place on Earth, takes place in, is called Puente Antigua, which is literally translates to old bridge or ancient bridge, which Kenneth Branagh thought was fitting since it's the location like where the Bifrost sends individuals to Earth. And where they shot was essentially this old town that just existed to be a film set, and many Westerns were shot there. And it existed in New Mexico, which is where the setting within the film is also. And Kenneth Branagh found this town and thought that it was a great location to shoot because he wanted the confrontation between Thor and the Destroyer towards the conclusion of the film to have like a Western vibe to it, like two cowboys facing off in the middle of the street in a shootout. Mm. And so he also said that this was the first production that actually paved over the roads on the set, because everything else had been like dust roads. And Kenneth Branagh wanted to shoot in New Mexico specifically because the sky just seems so vast and endless when you're in the middle of the New Mexico desert. And he thought that that big sky would evoke a sense of the vastness of space and a reminder of Thor's role as the God of Thunder.
Okay. So quick question. Mm-hmm. It's very off topic. Okay. Have you seen Once Upon a Time in Hollywood?
Of course I have. It's my favorite Quentin Tarantino movie.
Oh, okay. Well, like, I can't hear Western anymore without thinking of that movie. Uh-huh. So, like, that's just where my mind went when you talked about Westerns.
It's like you immediately think of Leo as Jake Cahill, like, chilling on the set.
Yes.
Yes. We need to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood at some point, Hagen, because I have very strong feelings. My next Thor fun fact is that Natalie Portman was drawn to the role of Jane Foster because, in her own words, don't laugh at me because my second fact is Natalie Portman related, okay? In her own words, she said, quote, "Kenneth Branagh doing Thor is super weird. I've got to do it," end quote. She signed on before there was even a script, and Branagh allowed her to help create the film's characterization of Jane, and she's credited with coming up with making Jane an astrophysicist instead of a nurse, as she is in the comics.
Interesting.
Why are you saying interesting in that tone?
Because one of the things we, like, I mean, I feel like we'll get to this later, but one of the things we were complaining about the movie before, like, getting into this is, I don't know, it seems I have some ammo for an argument later, that's all.
Okay, I know you do, and I don't know that I have a great line of defense, so moving on. Tom Hiddleston had worked with Sir Kenneth Branagh multiple times prior to this film. I believe he was actually working on a play with Branagh when Branagh signed on to direct this film, and Tom Hiddleston originally auditioned for the role of Thor, but Branagh thought that he was more fitting for the role of Loki. And Hiddleston was told to observe a strict diet in order to give Loki a hungry look and a distinctive form, which was very different from Thor's imposing strength. Hiddleston based his
hungry look.
Yeah. Like, he was literally supposed to look like somewhat emaciated and like he was constantly hungry, you know, both on a like physical level and a metaphorical level.
Right.
Hiddleston based his performance on both Edmund from King Lear and Peter O'Toole's performances in The Lion in Winter and Lawrence of Arabia.
Huh.
Tom Hiddleston truly was galaxy braining his character of Loki. Chris Hemsworth.
The amount of times you've said galaxy brain in like the last hour.
I've only said it once since we've been recording. Shh, don't tip the people off. Chris Hemsworth's original audition did not go over well, as he had a head cold at the time. He was initially dropped from consideration altogether, but was brought back in when the search for the perfect Thor came up empty. His second audition made it clear to Branagh and to Marvel that he was right for the part. That one is so interesting to me because Chris Hemsworth just is so, like, perfectly, he so perfectly embodies Thor. And I know that's because we've seen him as Thor over the course of the past, like, 9 years. But right. It just, he seems like one of those instances where, like, the casting would have just, like, he would have walked in the room and everyone would have been like, you're hired. We found the guy, you know?
Right. Especially if he had the hair at the time, like, which I don't know if he did or not when he did his first audition. But
I,
like,
feel like he probably did not, but...
Yeah, but I can't picture anyone else, all.
Like, and I know that that's true of a lot of characters throughout the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but I feel like none more so than Chris Hemsworth and Robert Downey Jr. Like, those are the two that, like, I feel like... Yes, Chris Evans is always going to be linked with Cap, and there are others like that too. But the two that I most strongly immediately associate the actor with the role are RDJ as Tony Stark and Chris Hemsworth as Thor.
Yeah, I would agree with you, though.
Yeah. Kenneth Branagh admits that when he approached Chris Hemsworth about his infamous shirtless scene, the director thought it was extremely important to show how imposing Thor was physically, but he wasn't sure how Hemsworth was going to react. Chris Hemsworth reportedly laughed and said, "Of course I'm fine taking my shirt off. I didn't train for months not to show this off." I just love that. I also love that it wasn't in the script. Like, you would think that that would have been in the script. Like, that Chris Hemsworth would have been aware that he was going to be walking around shirtless.
Fact that that's... No, just because, like, you're right. Like, I can't... How is that not in the script? Like, because, feel like he would... really care, but, like, shouldn't it just, like, be there?
Right. Especially because, like, there's, like, the lines of dialogue in that scene are based around him being shirtless.
Right.
Which also brings me to the fact that a lot of Chris Hemsworth's line deliveries and readings, like Sir Kenneth Branagh says, were, like, not given to him, in that, like, he wasn't told, oh, like, make this line funny. So a lot of the, like, very serious, almost Shakespearean lines that he delivers on Earth that come across as very funny, like, their humor was Chris Hemsworth, not the script. Which I really enjoy.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. Kenneth Branagh instructed Sir Anthony Hopkins to improvise his reaction to Thor yelling at him during their emotional confrontation. Reportedly, everyone on set who witnessed the filming of that scene wept.
Wow.
Branagh wanted the film to be rife with biblical, mythological, and historical imagery and allusions. He saw the central familial conflict as decidedly Shakespearean in nature and played up those Shakespearean aspects. One of my favorite allusions in the film is in the scene where Odin casts Thor out. He pulls his cape off of him and he strips him of his epaulets. And mm-hmm. Sir Kenneth Branagh specifically choreographed that so that it would evoke images of the Dreyfus affair, when Dreyfus had his epaulets pulled off of him, which I just think is a very interesting historical parallel to be drawing in that scene. My little Judaic studies brain is blown.
I was going to say, I'll give you one guess as to what I thought of when I heard the word biblical.
Christopher Rolston. He has now been name dropped in this podcast.
Now you have to send it to him.
No, not half. Despite the Shakespearean implications and allusions, Branagh notes that he was careful not to burden the Thor-Jane relationship with any Romeo and Juliet qualities. He didn't want the romance to seem too epic, but rather like a genuine connection between two people who were attracted to one another. He wanted the relationship to seem realistic and simple, and credits the performances of Portman and Hemsworth with helping him achieve that vision. We'll discuss whether or not you think they achieved that vision later on, Hagen.
Okay.
And Sir Kenneth Branagh also says that in most test screenings, audiences reported the scene of Jane and Thor discussing the Hubble-Hubble telescope and him describing the Nine Realms to her as their favorite scene in the entire film. Jeremy Renner was not yet cast when they filmed the scene within which Hawkeye provides air coverage, like he's looking down at Thor just on his tirade through the shield. Shield, what would you call that? Base? Like, quickly erected base, I guess? I don't know.
Or, like, camp or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. But, so Clark Gregg was speaking to no one when he radioed to Hawkeye to get up and provide eyes in the sky. And Jeremy Renner was added in later once he was officially cast in the role as Hawkeye. Kenneth Branagh notes that on the promotional tour for this film, a lot of interviewers fixated on the fact that this was Natalie Portman's first film, which was produced entirely post Black Swan. And they framed their questions directed towards her much in the manner of, like, what's it like to go from such an indie, creatively fulfilling project to a giant, seemingly perfectly manufactured blockbuster where, like, you don't have any creative freedom? And Natalie Portman reportedly responded by saying that due to, like, the budgetary nature of the films, on Black Swan, she only had a few moments to, like, make important character decisions and to focus on individual scenes. Like, it was like, bam, like, I do this scene, I move on to the next one. And she didn't really have time to, like, dwell on the creative decision she was making. But on Thor, because the budget was of no consequence, like, literally, you know, Marvel was throwing money at this movie, that they had time to play with the characters. And so the scene where she drives Thor out to the crash site of Mjolnir, his hammer, they actually took all day to shoot that one scene.
So pronounce it?
Mjolnir?
Isn't it like Mjolnir?
Yeah. Don't make fun of my southern accent. Don't come for me right now, Megan.
No, I genuinely just thought you pronounced it differently. I'm used to the accent.
Sure. Sure you are. You've been back in Ohio for so long, you're forgetting. But they had all day to shoot that one scene. And so she and Chris Hemsworth got to play around with it, got to approach the scene, you know, coming from different emotional perspectives. And so she said that actually she found it not necessarily, like, more enjoyable, but almost more creatively fulfilling to play a role in a Marvel movie than to play a role in an indie like Black Swan. Mm. Another fact that I really enjoy is I've always wondered this while watching the movie, and the commentary finally revealed the meaning behind it, is many scenes in this movie begin with Dutch angles, which are, like, somewhat diagonal or sideways angles. And Kenneth Branagh was very adamant that he wanted those Dutch angles to be included within the film because he says that that's how he sees comic books a lot of the time. And seeing those angles orients your brain the way that, like, reading a comic book orients his brain. And so he thought, he was like, Marvel Studios came to him and was like, there's a lot of Dutch angles here. And Branagh was like, no, they're important to, like, the style of the film. And so I thought it was interesting that he argued so strongly for those to be left in. And they definitely are. There's a lot of them. And he says on the commentary, he's like, I hope you don't think there's too many of them. And I was like, Ken, there sure are a lot. And he also styled the town, which he got to create because it was, you know, just a large filming set, after what he imagined Middle America to be like, based on images from comic books. And that's why certain colors pop so much. And that's why it's a very, like, quaint view of, like, the American small town. You know, like, they eat in the diner and, like, everyone knows everyone. And it's just very, like, picturesque. And so it's because it's based on Sir Kenneth Branagh's conception of what Middle America looks like based on comic books. And the water tower in the town says Home of the Vikings as homage to Norse mythology from whence the story and characters here derive. And my last fun fact is one that I really enjoy. The last shot in the film, which shows, like, Jane and Darcy and Selvig, it's when, like, Thor's asking Heimdall what Jane's up to. And you see her and Darcy kind of running around. And you know that they're, like, about to go observe, you know, another phenomenon. That actually was originally supposed to be the first shot of the film. And it was going to precede, like, them driving out into the desert. And then Sir Kenneth Branagh thought that it fit really well at the closing of the film, and that's, like, it fit when Heimdall is saying that Jane is searching for Thor. And so he made what originally was the first shot one of the closing shots of the film.
That's a good one. I like that.
Yeah, very interesting. So now that I have given my fun facts, not all of which were about Natalie Portman, you must admit, I now think that we can move into our discussion. You know it's true. So, Hagen, I'm now going to give you the opportunity to talk about your experience with this movie. Can you remember the first time you saw it? How many times do you think you've seen it since? And what have subsequent viewings been like?
Yeah, no. So I remember the first time I saw this was not in theaters. So it was like, it was at my friend's birthday party in like fifth or sixth grade or whichever year that was. And we all were like just watching it like in the basement at like 12 or something. And wait, okay, what was the rest of the question? Or was it just that?
Yeah, and just like how many times do you think you've seen it total now?
Yeah, no, I've probably seen it like maybe 4 or 5 times total, because I saw it then, and I've probably rewatched it once or twice, like for personal, like catching up on the characters. And I know I've rewatched it at least once with like friends who were like going through their, you know, Marvel movie marathons, you know, to prepare for Endgame, especially for people who like, you know, came onto the scene late. And then I, of course, watched it a few days ago to prepare for this. So,
yeah, I'd say like 5. Very low number, Hagen.
Is it?
Yeah. I don't know. I have no idea how many times I've seen this movie. I do remember the first time I saw it. This movie came out in 2011. I had just turned 13, just like a week or two before this movie came out. And I can remember my teacher at the time, two of my teachers actually, Miss Matsu and Miss Abigail, shout out if either of you are listening right now. They had gone with their husbands to see this movie like shortly after it had come out. And they were like, Kyla, we think you would really enjoy this movie. It's like a really good superhero movie. And they had no idea that like I was definitely aware of this movie because of Natalie Portman. And I don't, like, for the life of me, I cannot figure out why I hadn't already seen the movie by the time they were recommending it to me. But Hagen and I were talking before we started recording about like there definitely is like a shift somewhere in your life where it goes from like when you don't get to make the decision about what movies you see in theaters versus like when you were in the driver's seat and picking what you go see in theaters and when you go see it. And so I guess that shift hadn't happened yet for me fully. But I did see it in theaters, with the on the recommendation of Ms. Matsuzaki and Ms. Abigail. And I really enjoyed it. And then I can't remember if this was like just as it came out on DVD, like, or shortly before then or after then or what, but I do know that my family went on a cruise like at some point not long after this movie had come out. And if you've listened to my episode of Closer, you've heard me tell the story, so I'll be very brief and won't like go into too many details, but basically we encountered a tropical storm on this cruise, and so like everyone got really sick, like even the like crew on the ship. And so like there was like nothing to do. And, you know, on cruises, they play, like, there are certain channels that just play one movie on an incessant loop. And one of the movies was Thor. And so I literally spent, like, 4 days watching Thor, like, nonstop, 24 hours a day.
Oh, my gosh.
And my parents were like, please change the channel. And I was like, no. But it was fine.
No, that reminds me of like, okay, one small coincidence though is, so actually the friend whose like house I was at when I first saw it, like we went to middle school together, but we didn't go to the same high school. And then I saw him for like the first time in like who knows how many years, like 6 years maybe, like a week ago when I was like picking up food at Panera. So I just find it a coincidence that we're talking about this movie so shortly after that happened. Yeah.
I can't believe you're going to Panera without me, Hagen. I'm heartbroken.
I know. But we're still having the post-Panera discussions.
So exactly. Okay. That's what this is. They're just being recorded for everyone. But anyways, so after that cruise, I have memories of like watching Thor in our little upstairs like movie watching area, which is just a hallway, but we act like it's a movie viewing room. And I know I watched it there a few times, and then I probably went like 5 years without watching Thor, genuinely, and then have like fully submerged myself in my Thor fandom here recently. Probably like around Infinity War is when I like went back to it. And so I've probably seen this movie. I don't even know how many times I saw it on the cruise. But if I had to estimate, I've probably seen this movie 35 to 40 times.
Oh my gosh.
So, but like literally 90% of that was on that cruise ship.
Well, so. As long as you've seen this movie more than you've seen The Dark World, then I guess.
Oh, 1000%. I really think I've only seen The Dark World like 5 or 6 times.
She says only.
Yeah, only.
Only 5 or 6.
I've seen my favorite scene a million times, and no, I will not tell you what my favorite scene is. You have to tune in to the Dark World episode to find out.
Okay.
So now, Hagen, I'm going to ask you, what's your pit and what's your peak of Thor?
Okay, so my pit, we already discussed it a little bit earlier, but it's just how... In the scene where, like, Thor's fighting the Destroyer and, like, he goes up and he, like, talks to Loki and then he just gets smacked and flies across the street, right? Of all the people that are there, you know, there's, like, these 4 people he's supposedly known for thousands of years or whatever and, like, trained with and grew up with. And, like, they literally traveled across the universe to save him. The person who runs over to him to, like, you know, stand by his side is the girl he met 4 days ago that he's had like 5 conversations with total. And like, I'm not trying to like fully knock on the whole like Thor and Jane thing, but like, she's willing to die for him and like runs to him as he flies through the air. And like, it makes one thing if like the whole group runs to him, but like, she's the only one who runs to him and the rest of them are just like, yeah, okay, we'll just let her have this moment. While like their friend that they came here to save is dying and they're just like, yeah, whatever, we'll stand here, it's okay. Like, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So that's a low point in the movie for me. But yeah, do you want to share your low point before I get to some of my highs?
Yeah. I think that this is not what I had planned to say. I actually had another answer planned, but as we've been talking, I think that my pit might be when Loki visits Thor while he's being detained at the S.H.I.E.L.D. camp and tells him that Odin is dead. Because I just really... That scene just... Chris Hemsworth does some really good, like, strictly facial acting in that scene. And Tom Hiddleston is definitely near his best as Loki in that scene also. So, like, it's a really well-acted scene, but it also... And it serves a great purpose because it's the turning point in Thor's character, like the full, like where he does a full 180. But I don't know. It's just, I can remember as a kid that scene just very much disturbing me because I didn't know at the time, like if I didn't know that Loki was lying the first time, you know? And so I think that the emotional wallop it packed on me as a 13-year-old, I'm going to go with that one. So now okay. You can say your peak.
Okay, wait, so that was, like, your least favorite, as in, like, just it was a tough scene to watch, but not, like, a badly done one.
Yes, there are no badly done scenes, Hagen.
Okay. Interesting choice. Okay. But, yeah, so I guess my peak could be, I don't know, I just really enjoyed all of the, like, little humorous lines where, like, Thor is like just gotten to Earth and he's like, this mortal form is like not what I'm used to. And then he, you know, and like the smashing of the mug and then another. Like, yeah. And, what was another one? And then like, you know, when he's just had just gotten out of the hospital or something and then, they're like in the van and they're about to go find him and then she backs up right into him. So just like,
I swear I'm not doing this on purpose.
Like, I just feel like Thor as a character, and then Chris Hemsworth as an actor, and then like the Thor franchise within the Marvel franchise, like I think that particular part of it, they do really good humor in comparison to all the other like characters that they work with. And so like I'm always just a sucker for the humor that they throw in there.
Mm-hmm. And how much more do you enjoy it now knowing that a lot of it was Chris Hemsworth's idea?
Oh, no, I thought that was really great because like I can totally see how they would have it scripted, you know, like the whole like the smashing the mug thing just being like much more stoic. But like the way, you know, he does it and he's like, what? No, I enjoyed it. And they're like, well, you could have just asked nicely and that whole thing. Like I can totally see how that could have been a lot lamer, you know. And so I'm really glad that it was done that way and that it was like that he took the initiative to do that. It's just like, you know, kind of how you can, you know, take a phrase and then if you just say it slightly differently, it's a lot more sarcastic or something like that. And I think just making it feel right always makes it end up feeling better for the audience. So I'm glad he did that for sure. And it's really cool to know that that's how it ended up happening. Like it was a natural decision. So I'm a fan.
Yeah, I really enjoy that fact. My peak stereotypical, I know, but I think I'm going to have to go when the hammer comes to him and revives him. And he's standing and, you know, his armor is like he's coming back to him and everything. It's just, it's such a powerful image. It's so like the music mounting, the lightning surrounding him, like it's just, it's so well handled. And it's what we have come to, like it's the type of imagery and visual that we've come to expect to accompany Thor, like within the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But that was kind of like the first time we saw Thor in like truly all his glory, you know? Right. And so I just really, really enjoy that image and that moment.
That makes me think, I also, like, I can't believe I left this out, but when he's storming the camp, like, I love that sequence, the whole, like, all of it. I like the, you know, I'm starting to root for this guy. And just the way, like, what, are you going to send more people in to beat him up or what? I really like that whole sequence. And especially how, you know, he walks up to it, like, so confidently and, like, pauses for a second. Expects to just lift it up, and then the sequence of which he goes, you know, two hands straining and then like yelling at the sky. You know, I thought that was really good acting, and I like that portion.
Yeah, I do like that sequence a lot. I like everything about it. I like the intensity, like juxtaposed with the humor coming from Hawkeye's commentary, and also Jane calling Selvig and being like, I did exactly what you told me not to do and I need you to come bail me out. Like, it's just, it's all around, like, it's such an all-over-the-place sequence, but it works.
Yeah, I also just love how Coulson's in charge of this whole thing and not Fury. Because it could have just as easily been Fury doing all of those lines and scenes, because it's such a small, like, portion. But the way it's Coulson, like, I think impacts the series as a whole. It makes Fury a little bit more mystical and mysterious.
Mm-hmm. And makes Coulson more of the beating heart of Phase 1, too.
Exactly, yeah. And then, of course, you know, when he calls him Son of Coal.
Yes, my favorite line in the whole movie.
Yeah, I was going to say, I wasn't sure if we were going to be sharing our favorite lines or not later. So I wanted to make sure I brought it up, because that is, without a doubt, like, at the very least, top three. But, like, again, I don't have super strong feelings for, like, any particular part of this movie. I'm not emotionally connected to any individual thing. So, like, that could easily be my favorite line.
Hear this, Son of Coal. So good. Because I feel like it took me seeing the movie at least twice for, like, me to be like, oh, I get it. You know what I mean? Like, Odin's son. Okay. It's so good. Do you have any favorite shots from this movie, Hagen?
I like how they do Now, I don't know how much is like based on like where they're actually filming this or where, or if it's just like CGI type stuff, but I like there's parts of it when they're in Jotunheim that like looks very nice and like nature-y, tundra-esque, and I like that. Mm-hmm. I like that vibe.
I'll accept that. I have two lesser than favorite shots, one of which I've already mentioned, which is when he catches the hammer. But my other shot that I really enjoy, but it's not quite my favorite, is the first shot we get of Asgard, where like we see it from below, and the camera like pans up through the clouds, and then we get our first like true like view of the Asgardian skyline. I just really enjoy that, and I think it was an interesting way to like start from the bottom and pan up. But my overall favorite shot in this movie, it's one that Sir Kenneth Branagh has described as being one of his favorite shots also, is when Laufey, the King of the Frost Giants, approaches Odin and opens his eye, and you see the reflection of Laufey in Odin's eye. Like, I just think that's such a brilliant shot. And, you know, it's coupled with the very menacing line of, like, they say that you can see everything in this state, and I hope that's true so that you know that your death came at the hand of Laufey. And I just feel like the visual there is so important, and it's so well executed. And I'm a sucker for like close-ups on eyes, and I love reflections in eyes, and that's one of the best, I think.
Yeah, I think also I forgot about this one, but when they first when S.H.I.E.L.D. first gets to the crater where the hammer is, and like the stepping out of like the vehicle like panning up, and then you see like Coulson, like, again, because he is like the heart and soul of like phase one and all that, and I like Phil, so you know, it's hard, he can do almost no wrong in my book.
I'll agree with you there. I will. Okay, so now favorite lines.
Okay. Well, we already started with some of Thor's just like little like mannerism type things, like, you know, son of Cole, another.
I also I can't believe we didn't mention this one, but I need a horse. The pet store owner being like, we don't have horses, just dogs, cats, birds. He's like, give me one of those large enough to ride.
Yeah.
Like, again, the delivery is so key there.
Right. Because like you could totally see him doing that, like, you know, straight faced. And in a way, like, you can do that in a funny way, but I like the way he did it a little more. Yeah, like the just how earnest it is. But then also, like, Darcy has like pretty much every line Darcy has is a good line. I don't think she has any bad lines, or just mediocre lines.
Like, Darcy Lewis is the most underrated character in the MCU.
I mean, I won't argue with you. Okay. I think you're open to that opinion. I mean, she does no wrong.
It's true.
It's pretty much like all her screen time is good screen time, but I don't think that makes her underrated, because it's like, if you ask anyone's opinion about her, it's just that she doesn't like start a lot of conversations.
She should, she should. We should be talking more about Darcy.
Okay. But like, especially in the very beginning, you know, as a college student myself, like, I really, I felt her struggle where she's like, I'm not dying for 6 college credits.
Again, how is she getting 6 credits out of her internship with Jay? Please let me know.
Maybe it's one of those things. Well, maybe it's one of those things where they just like count them differently.
Okay, I'll accept that, I guess.
Well, because I remember, this is totally unrelated, but when I was touring like a school, this one family was asking, you know, the tour guide, like, how many credits do people like typically have before they graduate? And they were like 30 or 40 or something like that. And they're like, no, like, you know, but typically, like, I think it's either 120 or 128 or something like that. And they're like, whoa, what? And then they like explained how it worked. So whatever they were used to was something very different. So,
okay. All right. I'll accept that.
It's possible.
Any other Darcy lines strike your fancy?
She's a political science major.
Aren't you a scientist? Political science.
I think we can both resonate with that one as well. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, no, I don't think she says a single line that isn't funny.
Yeah.
Like, no, the iPod.
That's up there with Son of Cole for my favorite. They took my iPod. Years of research gone. I just downloaded like 300 new songs. Will you shut up about the iPod? Like, it's so good. It's so, so good. I also really enjoy, there's a couple of the really funny ones that I enjoy that don't come from Darcy, but I love it when the S.H.I.E.L.D. agent radios in and is like, Mace, we've got Xena, Jackie Chan, and Robin Hood. So Lady Sif and the Warriors 3 arrive. It's just so good. It's so good. And, the portrayal of, I'm gonna get it wrong if I try to specify, but the portrayal of the Warrior 3 that they are referring to as Robin Hood is actually based, it's Josh Dallas's fan draw, and he actually was basing his performance on Errol Flynn as Robin Hood. So I just really enjoy that line. It's like a nice little full circle moment. I also love it when one of the random S.H.I.E.L.D. agents is like, is this one of Starks? And Coulson is like, I don't know. Guy never tells me anything.
And then the way they just talk through it, like, you have an unregistered weapon.
Yeah. It's so good. And then, also Darcy ogling Thor throughout the movie is good too. And she's like, does he need CPR? Because I totally know CPR. And she's got a couple others like that. In terms of serious lines, I really enjoy Jane's whole speech about, like, at a time when we couldn't understand certain phenomenons, like, we considered them magical or, like, beyond the scope of rationalization, so, like, they couldn't be true, but, like, right. What to say that there aren't things that are beyond our scope of understanding now that one day are going to be true? And magic's just science we don't understand yet. Arthur C. Clarke, who wrote science fiction, a precursor to science fact, you know, like, I enjoy that whole exchange. And then I love it when Thor basically says the same thing later in their scene that most test audiences described as their favorite scene, when he's saying, your ancestors call it magic and you call it science, but I come from a place where they are one and the same.
Right.
I just think those are interesting lines. I enjoy them. Oh, and one more funny one that I point out every time I watch this movie, and because I feel like other people don't get what I get from it, is when Thor goes back to his, like, full godly form, and the camera zooms in on Jane, and she's going, oh my god. I laugh every single time because it's literally her god. Like, she has her own personal god that she is now dating. Like, I just think that's hilarious.
Well, I mean, they're technically not dating, but okay.
They're official in all but name.
Okay, so they're not dating.
Okay, whatever. She has her own personal god. That's what matters. And so, like, the okay. Oh my god, like, the possessive my just takes on a different meaning.
Yeah, no, I like that scene.
Oh my god.
Okay.
Yeah. So, now I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk or to respond to all the things I've said about, like, Sir Kenneth Branagh's intentions and his direction, the style he was going for, because I feel like if you don't listen to the commentary, some of the things he was going for may not land as well as I think that he believes that they do or believes that they should. So do you think that, you know, his commitment to telling a story rife with, like, biblical allusions and Shakespearean parallels and everything, like, does it play well? And do you feel like his artistic vision was fulfilled in a way that is pleasing to general audiences?
I don't know if I recognized a lot of it, but I think I passively like, appreciated it.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I think a lot of those, like, biblical and Shakespearean connections are not things that I was like, oh, and this is a thing that you can see in this play done by Shakespeare when he was, you know, in his fifth year of production. Like, I didn't see that. But, like, hearing it makes sense, and I definitely appreciated the kind of, you know, the stoicism involved and the parodies to, like, you know, a child being banished and stuff like that that follow more kind of classical tropes. So, like, I appreciated those for sure. And especially, okay, I know you didn't ask about this thing yet, but the, like, Dutch angles, definitely not something I thought about. But if now, especially upon having just seen it, like, you, most scenes are from that diagonal kind of direction. And it does feel very comic book-esque, much more than the other movies do. And I think that's one of the reasons the humor is able to get played so lightly as well. Because a couple of nice lines with that angle, and you have, like, a classic, like, pow, wham, yeah, type thing, you know? And I think that's a really nice vibe to have for, like, a blockbuster superhero movie. So I'm a fan.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do think that it makes the vibes of this film, like, entirely singular and very, like, distinct from other Marvel installments. And I like that about it. I think that's one reason I return to it as often as I do, because it is, like, definitely its own entry into the larger canon, and it's not trying to be, like, just a strictly, like, prepackaged, overly manufactured Marvel movie. And I'm not saying that other Marvel movies don't have good direction, but I'm just saying, like, there is something so distinct.
You're not?
We'll get into that in other episodes. But, like, Kenneth Branagh is definitely doing something just very individualized and artistic, and I appreciate that. And I agree with you that his allusions to, like, larger biblical themes and, you know, Shakespearean comparisons and everything, they're handled with just the right touch, where they're not so heavy-handed that it's like, if you don't pick up on it, you're missing everything, so that you can just sort of passively appreciate it. And it doesn't have to be something that, like, your brain is actively thinking about as you are enjoying your viewing, you know?
Right. I think it just gives, like, layers to which, if you care enough to learn about it, you can then, you know, rewatch and appreciate it. Just the same way, you know, when you reread a book or a series, when you know how it ends and you can, like, really appreciate the foreshadowing involved that, you know, you might not have picked up on because it was the first book in the series and you weren't very familiar with the characters or stuff like that. And you were too busy trying to piece the world together that you couldn't pick up on this, like, detail that was right in front of you. And then you reread it and you're like, it was blatantly obvious. How didn't I see it coming? You know? And I think, like, especially, like, the angles thing, that's the thing I would say I noticed the most just right now, more so than the whole biblical references, but I mean, they're there too. So
yeah, so what, Hagen, do you think makes a good superhero origin story?
So I think you have to make the superhero an underdog, obviously. Because, you know, you can't just give them powers in a sense where, like, oh, this person has powers now and no one else does, and, you know, all of a sudden they're just, like, amazing. And then you have to give them, like, a reason to be fighting. Like, because I don't know about you, but if I just got powers, like, tomorrow, 90% of the time I'd probably just use it to make daily life easier. You know, like, I wouldn't be, okay, now I can just go out and start fighting crime. This is the dream I've always had. You know, like, I don't think I'd jump right to it, but that's what always happens. So I think you have to have a good enough reason other than just, like, now you can. Like, you have to have a reason why you should. So there's that. There's the underdog thing. And then, let's see, what else? I really like when the backstory makes sense. And I don't mean like the origin story. I mean the backstory of like the world or their powers or stuff like that. I really like when they can just come up with some sort of fake science or whatever that makes it like, you know what? Like, I can see this. Like, I'm not trying to poke holes in it.
Yeah.
Like, I think sometimes when it's too simple or too complicated, it's just like, come on, buddy. So I really like when the origin story is really balanced in the sense that you can like appreciate it and accept its complexity, but also recognize that it's not overly complex, that they're just trying to force this thing at you. So yeah, I'd say those are like three nice boxes to check among many others.
Yeah, and I'll agree with you that I think all of those three are very important. I do think that it's somewhat difficult to like lay out exactly what makes a good origin story when you're already in the frame of mind of discussing Thor, because I think Thor checks different boxes as an origin story than most like typical superhero origin stories do. And for that reason, I want to ask, like, what do you think Thor as an origin story gets right? And then do you think it's even fair to characterize Thor as an origin story?
So first of all, I'd say yes, you can definitely characterize it as an origin story because it shows his origin as a superhero on Earth, mm-hmm. right? And although there's some minor references to how he must have traveled to Earth before and, like, you know, been worshipped by mortals, as they said, you know, which I assume is a throwback to, like, the time when Norse mythology was what people believed. So, like, yes, he's probably been to Earth before, but he's never fought things on Earth. There haven't been threats on Earth that are things that he would deal with in war. So this is his origin to that battlefield, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I would say it can definitely still count. As for checking the boxes, I think it does the really good redemption arc trope where, like, you first watch it and, like, you don't dislike Thor, but you don't really, like, love him in the beginning. At least I don't. I find him funny at times, but I'm not just like, you know, this is the super nice guy that I just want to like root for, or like sweet guy or whatever. He's just like, or like some like bad guy with like, you know, a hidden like emotion side that makes you connected to him. He's just like kind of full of himself, is a little bit hot-headed, and you're like, eh, whatever. Like, that's kind of a harsh punishment, but, you know, we'll see what happens. And he has a really nice redemption arc in the way he kind of accepts his fate. And the humor is, again, just so important at making you like him as part of the redemption. Because, like I said, he was never bad enough to dislike, but he wasn't great enough to love at the start. And so that makes you start to really appreciate him as a character removed from his powers. And then, you know, you kind of see him go through these struggles as like a mortal that has all this training and is trying to, his real struggle is that of just figuring out what's right and wrong versus how do I use my powers to defeat someone more powerful than me. So he's the underdog in the sense that his powers are still removed, and therefore he is an underdog to the situation he's in. And the whole like complexity thing, I think they do a really good job with, because, you know, they're just taking Norse mythology to a degree and being like, okay, they're basically just like more powerful beings that live on a different planet that have technology. So I thought that I think they did a really good job with it. I don't, off the top of my head, I don't really have any issues with it as an origin story, but if you have stuff to poke at it, I'm interested to hear.
It's not really that I have anything to poke at it. It's just that, you know, I think that Thor occupies a very interesting space, like within the Marvel Cinematic Universe and within the superhero genre as a whole, because I would classify it as an origin story, but most origin stories are like extremely formulaic. They have one central villain, like, for the entirety of the story. Not that Loki isn't the central villain. We'll talk specifically about Loki and his role as the antagonist in a few moments. But, like, there's usually multiple conflicts with one singular entity, and also usually the origin story deals with the origins of the hero's powers, like how they come by them. And so the fact that we encounter Thor, you know, as someone who has already done all these great heroic things and has already seemingly mastered his powers, even though he hasn't mastered, you know, himself, is just very interesting. But I would still classify it as an origin story. It's just an origin story unlike any other, I would say.
Yeah, and I would definitely say the interesting thing about that, the whole, like, mastering their powers type thing, is, like, they specifically say, so whoever holds this hammer holds the power of Thor, which is mm-hmm. interesting because it's making his power as more of a metaphor than his actual power. You know, mm-hmm. like, as if the power of Thor is not his power, but more of, like, just this thing that exists to those who are worthy.
Right.
And his quest to becoming worthy is his quest of mastering his powers, because he has to be worthy in order to have the powers of Thor.
Mm-hmm.
So, I like that part.
Yeah, I enjoy that also. So, what I was getting at is that this film exists at, like, a very interesting critical juncture in the MCU, where the ideas of the universe were still somewhat nebulous and the formula hadn't fully been discovered yet. So do you think that this film benefits from its placement within the larger universe, and are there detriments to that placement also?
Okay, first of all, I just need to comment on the fact that I'm not actually going to talk about what you think, is that when you started saying that, like, I knew you were going to say juncture, and then you did. And then you also said nebulous, which I made fun of you for a little bit before we started. Yes. Just because Kyle has such a unique vocabulary that I enjoy to mock, but I appreciate it.
You're just like roasting me. It's fine.
I'm sure it's very mutual.
it is.
Anyway, so what's, can you just rephrase the main point of the question?
Yes. Basically, I'm saying Thor exists in this realm where Marvel was starting to sort out, like, this is what our movies are. This is how they look. This is, you know, how the plot proceeds. But because Thor predates, like, the formula being fully set in stone, it has more, like, creative liberty that is allowed within the film. So, like, do you think that the movie benefits from being so unique? And do you think that there are detriments to the fact that, like, Marvel hadn't fully found its definitive footing yet?
I mean, I don't think it benefits as much as others might say. Definitely because, you know, once one character or another starts doing really well, like, for example, Thor is clearly one of the more popular Avengers with his standalone movies. I mean, sure, like, the Dark World will pass on that one, but the rest of it, you know, is just, and the way he shows up in the Avengers movies, and he's clearly, like, one of the most powerful one-on-one. And so because of that, yes, they had maybe a little bit more creativity at first, but they also get to just expand on that creativity throughout his development, because the fan base grows and they're like, people are going to come watch this and we want to grow him as a character and give them a reason to keep coming back. So you don't want to stick to the same cut and dry thing when it comes to a movie about, like, the one superhero, because mm-hmm. otherwise, like, where do you go from there? And which I think is, again, especially evident, you know, by the time Ragnarok happens. So I don't think that they got any, like, huge benefits by the creativity. I think the creativity here might have definitely led to future things with Thor. But, like, mm-hmm. I think you kind of see it throughout a lot of the movies that they really, I think they tried to be more creative than some people might give them credit for with a lot of the different characters and movies. Because there's so many characters going on, like, they had to be careful to try not to recreate the same story in the sense of, you know, here's this classic good guy, here's this classic bad guy. You have to give them different angles to develop them at. Like, it can't all be I have to get stronger, or it can't all be I have to save my friend. You know, they're giving them a bunch of different angles to work from, and I like, so I think overall a lot of the movies actually show a lot of creativity as they get bigger, you know.
Yeah, I'll agree with you, and I do think I think one thing, though, that is important to note with this film is I think the way it has such a singular, like, creative voice led to the Thor individual films having the freedom to exert, like, their own creativity going forward. Because each Thor installments of the three thus far just have, like, such unique voices compared to other films in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I'm not knocking the other films at all. I'm just saying, like, no other movie feels exactly like Thor. No other movie is trying to be the Dark World, let's go ahead and admit. And Ragnarok is just a beast entirely its own. And I know if you would have, if the creators involved in Thor going forward after this first installment would have had the freedom to just have completely different tones and aesthetics and everything in those two follow-up films had this film not begun the process under the direction of Sir Kenneth Branagh.
Gotcha. I think that's a good point. But my overall thing is that I feel like the other films within the Marvel franchise, you know, demonstrate this as well. Like Guardians of the Galaxy is basically like this ragtag humorous version of the Avengers, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's like a completely different vibe. And so I think they do a good job of showing off creativity in a bunch of different ways, with other films and characters. But I would also say that you're right. This is probably the first one that does that, because the things before, like Iron Man, Captain America,
The Incredible
are
Hulk.
A lot more cut and dry. Sure. yeah, those ones are all a little bit more cut and dry, and more just about the strict character development, laying out the plot for the rest of the universe to come together. So I would say that if this one wasn't done as creatively as it was, then future movies within the Marvel universe might not have had the freedom to keep stepping outside of a box as well. Right. Which I think equally important.
Right. And I do think one thing that is also worth noting right here is that the three Thor films thus far have like the very unique designation of the fact that each one had a different director. And so like Guardians got to progress like under the creative vision of James Gunn, and there is like creative cohesion to what he is trying to do there. Whereas Thor, you know, Sir Kenneth Branagh's vision was completely different than Alan Taylor's, which was completely different from Taika's, you know?
Right.
And so I think that's interesting to note, too, that, like, Thor has had a completely different, like, creative process going on behind the scenes also.
Yeah.
So now I want us to talk a little bit about the production design within this movie. The visuals that are offered, specifically like Asgard, Jotunheim, the Frost Giants. Are you like particularly drawn? You talked about like how you enjoy some shots on Jotunheim. Like, what do you think this movie visually does really well? And are there things that don't work for you?
I don't think there's anything that like explicitly doesn't work. I don't think they do a fantastic job with anything particularly either, though. I think you're right, like, the Asgard scene, you know, coming up from, like, the bottom of the mountain type is very nice. Jotunheim has some nice scenes. The Frost Giants are a little bit lackluster to me. It's just, like, they're just kind of there. The Destroyer was actually well done, especially yeah. I liked how it was close enough to one of Stark's, as they put it, so that they could make that reference. I'm not sure if that was part of their planning with its design, but if it was, I like that. And I definitely like just, you know, the costumes and the stuff they did for all the Asgardians. But yeah, I'm not really like married to any particular scenes or shots, and I don't really hate any either, I think. So
yeah
yeah
I I pretty much agree with you. I like the design of Asgard, but I feel like better things are done with it in subsequent films. But I do like the design of the Frost Giants. I think that they are like the exact right like recipe of like menacing and ominous and all these like horrible qualities to be like threatening enough. And I think that that's one thing I will go on record as saying, not all Marvel movies have great like villainous designs. There are some that I just don't think visually do what they need to do. Right. And that's across all superhero films, actually, because the worst villain design to me is Steppenwolf from Justice League. But like, I just feel like that's something that some films like just really struggle with. And so I do want to give credit where I believe it's due and say that the Frost Giants, like, no, when I think of this movie, the first thing that springs to mind is not like, oh yeah, they had an awesome design for the Frost Giants. But like, I do think that they're handled well enough that like they fulfill precisely the role that they need to.
Yeah. And I like that, especially like Laufey is seen as like calculated, right? And not just, they're not just this brutish race of, you know, beings that like are pure evil. The whole way they're trying, like he tries to have peace when, you know, Thor like first arrives and stuff like that. Or, I mean, maybe his goal isn't actually peace, but like he at least is a smooth talker. So I like that aspect as well.
So now, Hagen, I want us to shift gears just slightly. And basically what I want us to do is go through the cast of this film and talk about the work that they do and how we think they embody the roles. Why are you laughing?
Nothing.
So one thing that I want to point out at the top of this little exercise is that this movie has such a strange cast. Like, and it's not a bad thing. Like, it's a great cast. But when Natalie Portman has the quote being like, Sir Kenneth Branagh doing Thor is super weird, I've got to do it. Like, it gets even weirder. It doesn't just start, begin and end with the fact that it's Sir Kenneth Branagh directing Thor. But the fact that you have Sir Anthony Hopkins, Renee Russo, Idris Elba, Jamie Alexander, Stellan Skarsgård, Tom Hiddleston, Natalie Portman, and then Kat Dennings thrown in also, and of course Mr. Chris Hemsworth. Like, it's just such a...
Says him last.
Well, because you saved the best for last. But it just is... I don't think that anyone... Like, if you wrote out the cast of this film and, like, posted it somewhere and didn't say what film it was for, I don't think people would assume this was about to be a superhero movie. You know? Like, this cast is just chock full of, like, very serious actors. And it's just hilarious to me that Marvel is able to bring them all together to make a superhero movie, which is, like, one of the things Marvel did very well from the very beginning, is they brought in actors who were going to carry the films. And that's probably one of the reasons Marvel has been able to endure the way that it has and, like, be such a cultural mainstay for so long, is because the actors keep people coming back just as much as the stories do. But let's just start with Sir Anthony Hopkins as Odin. What do you think of his performance here, Hagen?
I mean, I liked it. I thought he did a good job of just being this whole, like, you know, old wise dude. I still... The whole, like, heart attack type thing when, like, Loki's yelling at him. he portrayed it really well. But, like, have you seen the show Community?
Yeah.
Okay. You want to know what I think of, like, every time I see that scene? I think you already know because I mentioned Community. But, like, it looks exactly like when Pierce Hawthorne just, like, starts faking a heart attack to get out of a bad situation. So, like, it looked really fake. So that's, like, my one gripe with him.
Your one qualm there with Sir Anthony Hopkins. Yeah, I'll give you that. that scene doesn't really work super well for me either, because, like, I don't know, it just doesn't seem realistic, not just with the heart attack, but also, like, Loki's reaction. Like, it all just feels very, like, stilted, you know? Like, it just feels fake and very scripted.
Yeah.
So I'll give you that. But I just think that you absolutely had to have someone with just immense gravitas in the role as Odin. And I can't think of anyone better for that than Sir Anthony Hopkins. I can't imagine this movie starting with anyone else's voice, you know, like his narration over the prologue. I feel like it's just a very strong way to begin this film. Also, an interesting fun fact is that apparently Stan Lee had always wanted to play Odin, but when he found out that they had cast Sir Anthony Hopkins, he was like, oh, actually, that's better. So I would like to see like an edit as with Stan Lee on the throne of Asgard. But I do think that Sir Anthony Hopkins, and knowing that he improvised in that scene, the pivotal scene with Thor, where he casts him out, like he just, he does it so perfectly. I can't imagine it being done any other way. And knowing that that was just Sir Anthony Hopkins responding, like, in his own way and not in a scripted manner is just all the more impressive. So I don't really feel like this next actor has a ton to do in this movie, but we can't not, we cannot not mention sexiest man alive, Idris Elba. So is there anything you have to say about his performance as Heimdall?
His stoicism does such a good job of, like, it really matches the whole thing of him being, like, honor bound, you know? So, and that plays a, obviously, like, that's the whole part that he basically does is, you know, he's this extremely honor bound, like, guy. And so he's going to listen to Loki, and then that whole thing is like, I strip you of your citizenship. Great. I don't have to listen to you anymore, you know? That was good. So I don't know. I think he plays the part very well. I feel like that's a part that a lot of actors could play, you know, that can just have that emanating, you know, this space and just kind of like reverberating around it. Or around it or whatever, but like he did a very good job in that role, so I have no issues with it.
I agree. I think that it is a role, like you said, that a lot of actors could probably fulfill, but I am grateful that we have Idris Elba as the one fulfilling it. And I think that he's an interesting character to have, like, as a thread throughout the Thor installments, you know?
Right.
Because I feel like just watching this film, you, like, I don't think I walked out of Thor being like, yeah, that's going to be a character that's going to be in every installment going forward. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it works. So next, let's talk about Jamie Alexander as the Lady Sif.
Okay. I thought she did a really good job. I especially like the dynamic of, like, at the end, where she's going up to, like, you know, Thor's mother, as, like, you know, Thor is all sad or whatever, and she's like, how is he? And I thought that was just kind of well done, the way she's, like, kind of, like, holding herself back in a way or whatever. But also, in the beginning when Thor's like, who did, like, this as, like, a maiden warrior, and she's like, me? And he's like, well, but who helped?
True, but I supported you. Yeah.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what it was. I thought, like, that was a really good, just, like, indignant line that she had there. But I really liked her portrayal of the Lady Sif and the Warriors Three.
Which I know those
are different actors, but...
You have to say it all together, though. Also, since you mentioned the Warriors 3, I cannot believe I forgot this in favorite lines, but I have to mention, do not mistake my appetite for apathy, which I love. I think such an underrated line in the MCU. Like, it always makes me laugh. back to Jamie Alexander specifically, I think she's just perfectly cast in the role of Sif. And one thing, I love the subtlety of, like, the way they portray her relationship with Thor, where it could be so many things. You know what I mean? Like, it gave it the room to grow in the dark world of, like, oh, it, like, is she interested in Thor in that way? Is, like, are they just, you know, friends who have been in a lot of high-stress situations together? So there's, like, this loyalty and somewhat of a tension there. Like, I like that the film didn't feel the need to, like, strictly define it. And, like I said, just gave it the room to kind of grow as the film series went on.
Right, exactly.
And, like, there's just enough portrayed in, like, the way Jamie Alexander looks at Chris Hemsworth in certain moments where, like, you're like, okay, I could see this. And also props to her for the fact that, like, I did not immediately just dismiss her out of hand as being, like, potential competition to Jane. Like, I still enjoy Sif. There's not many actresses that can do that where I'm like, oh, I don't just hate you because you're in opposition to Natalie Portman.
There it is. Because you said Jane at first, and I was like, is it really just Jane that you're worried about?
Yeah, it's clearly Jane. Let's move on to Kat Dennings as good old Darcy Lewis.
Yes, absolutely perfect. Just, like, the sarcasm, the lines, the college credits.
the college, like, credits.
All of it. Just absolutely well done.
Well done all around, Kat Dennings. Yes. No, it's so rare that, like, in a Marvel movie, you have one person that, like, you can definitively point to and be like, they're the comic relief, they're the funniest person in that movie, because, like, part of the strength of Marvel movies is that they just are funny and all characters get, like, good moments. But no one walks out of this not being like, Darcy probably had the best lines. You know, even though Thor is hilarious, Darcy is unquestionably the plucky comic relief.
Right, and especially because, you know, Thor's hilarious in his own, like, that's just who he is, not understanding the world. She's funny, like, with a purpose.
Right. Right. So I feel like Darcy occupies such an interesting space in the MCU, because I can't really think of other examples that, like, fulfill the Darcy role, you know?
Yeah.
And so I like that for Kat Dennings.
Yeah, no, I was just trying to think of characters who do that, and yeah, no, I'm drawing a blank currently. So, well, yeah. Kind of, I'd say Drax in Guardians.
Yeah, but it's a completely different vibe to the comic.
Right, right. Like, that's not his, and right, like, that's almost entirely her sole purpose.
Right.
So yeah.
Yeah, okay. So what about Stellan Skarsgård as Erik Selvig?
I think he did a pretty good job. It was kind of the whole, like, father figure thing felt a little bit like, it was more of a tell without showing.
Yes, and it felt so, like, shoehorned in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, why did they never tell us, like, the history between Selvig and Jane's father?
Right. Well, no, they did. They were like, oh, we were, like, professors together. That was it.
Right, but, you, like, know? That's not enough. Like, I need more. If the entirety of your dynamic is going to be hinged on the fact that, like, you're loyal to her father and, like, feel the need to fulfill that role in her life, like, at least, if you're not going to show, at least tell me more about why you feel that way, you know?
Right. Yeah, and so, I don't know, and the whole scene where he's, like, telling Thor to, like, leave because he's bad news, and then it just, like, but it holds no weight, like, he doesn't actually, it's not like he leaves and then 15 minutes later and three scenes later he comes back out of coincidence to save the day. Like, he doesn't even leave because he ends up drinking too much. So, like, I'm not very attached to him as the actor or the character.
Yeah, me either. And it's nothing against Stellan Skarsgård. I think that he is a really great character actor. I just, one thing that watching this back to back, like with other installments and specifically Avengers, since we're doing our whole like Marvel month here, I've been watching a lot of Marvel movies, and I watched this one and Avengers back to back, and I just do not understand why Eric Selvig was singled out as like the character that was going to carry over into the Avengers. Because, and I'm not just saying this because I would like more Natalie Portman screen time, but wouldn't it make more sense for Jane to be the character that Loki's trying to control in the Avengers?
Right. No, like it makes, it does make more sense, especially because the whole thing in Avengers, right, where like they mention Selvig and then they're like, someone's like, who's that? He's some scientist guy. And then Thor's like, he's right. a friend. And it's like, well, are you even friends with him? Like, when right. did you become friends? I thought you were just, like, guys who coexisted.
Right. It just, you know, we talked about how Coulson so strongly becomes, like, the beating heart of Phase 1. And it feels like they tried to make Selvig some important, like, aspect to the Phase 1, like, continuation. But it just doesn't work. Like, I don't care about Selvig enough.
Yeah, especially in the whole thing where they're, like, you know, trying to show his connection to Norse mythology, right? And they're like, oh, but these are the stories he was told as a kid. Okay.
Like, it doesn't, like, it doesn't come back up, though, beyond him, like, yeah. like, Jane, these are the stories that my mother put me to bed with. And he's like, something he said reminded me, and I looked it up in this book. And then, like, there's no, like, actual payoff for that. You know what I mean?
Right. Like, it's not like they figure it out on their own. It's just like, oh, it ends up being real, and he like it's just, yeah, it's kind of oddly pieced together without, like you said, without any payoff.
Yeah, so more on our critique of Eric Selvig in our Avengers episode, I am sure. Let's go ahead and get this one out of the way. Natalie Portman as Jane Foster. I'll let you go first.
She did a good job. I mean,
you don't have to say that for me. I just want to go ahead and tell
you that. I think the creation of her character to the astrophysicist was good. And I'm glad that she had a part in that. But I also feel like there wasn't that much going on. And it was like, you know what I mean? Like, I feel like almost any mortal could have replaced her. Like, mm-hmm. and like, she didn't have to be an astrophysicist in the whole sense of like, he just runs into someone, they bring him into town, they help him a little bit more, he drags them along. You know what I mean? Like, yes, I guess there's the whole connection to that's why she was there, but sure. And then the romance thing, just like, I don't understand how like caught up they are in each other after 4 days of like, and 5 conversations.
Mm-hmm.
But like she did good.
Okay, Hagen, you can stop walking on eggshells now. I'm gonna put you out of your misery and let you know that I have a definitive ranking of Natalie Portman's performances, and she has 43 performances on the ranking.
Okay.
And Thor is number 41.
Okay.
So it's nothing against her. Like, it has everything to do with, I think, the writing for Jane. And I would love, like, we'll never know probably, but I would love to know, like, what from her contributions made it in to, like, the final characterization of Jane, and, like, what was, like, brought, like, took out in pre-production, what was left on the editing room floor. You know what I mean? Because I just feel like we don't get a full picture of who Jane is in the final cut of this film. Right. Like, we were talking before we began recording, and we were like, the only character traits she really has is that she's fully devoted to her work, seemingly has no friends.
Right, and, like, she's awkward. Why is she living in a van? Like, yeah. How did she get Darcy? Why was she only able to get a political science major?
Darcy was the only applicant. Like, we do know Darcy was the only applicant.
No, I know, but, like, why? And why was it political science that drove her to do that? You know, like, yeah. Again, why is she living in a van? like, doesn't astrophysicist jobs, like, I feel like if you have a doctorate degree in something very science-y, like, and you're doing like research like that, like most of the time you're going to get paid a decent amount. And I can't remember exactly what we were saying earlier, but I do know you said something when you were talking about her influence on the character. It was making me think like something about like there was some sort of hypocrisy there, because it's like, I don't know what like super important lines or moments that Jane as a character had. And this whole thing of like Thor, like, desperately wanting to get back to her, and like the reason he shouldn't like break the bridge is because of her, just felt off to me.
Yeah, that's what, okay, so I'm gonna go on record with an extremely hot take coming from me, I think, or maybe not, maybe it's just a tepid take, you can be the judge of that.
Okay,
but I really love the character of Jane Foster, so that's like my disclaimer, but I'm gonna go ahead and admit on the record, were Jane Foster not played by Natalie Portman, I think she would just be like a non-entity in my brain. Like, I really don't think that people would care about her if she weren't played by Natalie Portman.
So you think that people care about her?
I do think that people care about her. Maybe just strictly other Natalie Portman stans, I don't know. But like, she's not nowhere near as compelling as the other leading ladies in the early Marvel films. Like, she's no Peggy Carter, she's no Pepper Potts, you know? Like, and it pains me to admit that. And I'm hoping that in Thor Love and Thunder, we get to see a characterization of Jane that is truly compelling and fully like three-dimensional and everything.
Yeah, because I think she had a lot of opportunity at the beginning of the movie, but then like she really didn't actually have that much screen time,
right?
And I think that was part of it. It was just her like devotion. The problem, the biggest problem I think I had with her character, she has like this devotion to, you know, this research she's doing, but we don't know any reason why she's doing this research. We don't know how long it's been. You know, we don't know why she has Selvig really with her, or why she needs Darcy with her, why she needs to be in this van, you know?
You're so caught up on this van.
And clearly she, like, and she had an ex-boyfriend that just, like, left some clothes behind that fit Thor. But, like, there's all these, like, little bits and pieces, but, like, it doesn't end up amounting to her doing anything, especially, like you said, because she isn't in Avengers. And Selvig right. is. And it's just like,
yeah.
Like her being an astrophysicist doesn't end up accumulating to anything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you're right. I will say though, since I feel like I have been very negative to my girl Jane Foster, I do want to say that I really appreciate how awkward she is. And I feel like that absolutely was Natalie Portman's contribution to the role. And I feel like I feel like you're going to roast me for saying this, but I feel like there's never been a moment on film where Natalie Portman felt more like she was just playing Natalie Portman and not playing a role than the moment where she puts the cereal bowl in the cabinet and then turns back around and then is like, wait, that's not where that goes, and turns back around and pulls it out, puts it in the sink. It's just so awkward and seems so realistic and organic, and I really appreciate it.
There's never been a scene where she's been playing someone like herself. Oh my God. Okay.
I mean, Natalie Portman plays some really outlandish characters that don't at all seem like actual Natalie Portman. Let's go ahead and move on now before we get too bogged down in that line of discussion.
Wow, Kyla moving on from talking about Natalie Portman voluntarily.
Well, we have two more actors left to cover and then some follow-up questions before we close out, Hagen.
Okay.
So let's talk about...
By the way, wait, I need to say a quick disclaimer. Natalie Portman, if you do ever listen to this at some point, I do not dislike you in any way, shape, or form. I just have to, like, jokingly keep Kyla in check. That is all.
That is all. Thank you, Hagen. I'm sure she'll be very moved by that when she definitely listens to this episode.
Well, if she does, I don't want to create an enemy or anything.
Natalie Portman's going to, like, call you out. And I don't know how she would, because neither of you have most forms of social media. It'd have to be on Instagram. You're going to get, like, this random, like, deluge of comments on your Instagram. And you're going to be like, what has happened? It's going to be the, like, Natalie Portman has flamed you. Okay.
Decides to flame me, but doesn't praise you.
Right, exactly. She just comes through. That honestly is like the worst thing I could possibly imagine. Finding out she listened and did not reach out to me. Okay, Tom Hiddleston in the role of Loki.
The hunger thing actually kind of creeps me out a little bit now that I know that fact. I'm not going to lie. But, like, he's the perfect Loki. There's nothing else to be said. He's the perfect Loki. And, like, people love him for a reason. People want him to have a redemption arc so bad for that reason. So, yeah. He's the perfect Loki.
No, I agree with you. And, I mentioned earlier in terms of, like, actors who are so strongly associated with their roles. And, like, we specifically talked about Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Hemsworth. And, like, obviously Loki is not part of the Avenger lineup, but Tom Hiddleston as Loki is absolutely, like, those two names are inextricably linked. You know what I mean? Like, you're not...
Absolutely.
I think forever, when people think of Loki, they will think of Tom Hiddleston now. And I can remember being on Tumblr around the time this film came out. So many girls went crazy over Tom Hiddleston and were just, like, thirsting after him. And I did not get it. I was like, Chris Hemsworth is right there. But the older I get, the more I get it. So, like, I want to apologize for internally roasting all of you ladies out there who had it for Tom Hiddleston after Thor came out. Even though the hunger thing, like, just isn't really my type. But I do think
the hunger thing.
Yeah. But Tom Hiddleston, I think that his, like, Shakespearean background and his... You know, he's such a serious actor. I think that is to the benefit of audiences here, that he commits so fully to Loki, because I feel like Loki could have come across very differently had he been played by anyone who was not, like, 1,000% committed.
Right, because you could see him as this, like, lighthearted trickster type, but instead he's, like, this solemn, dark, still charming, but, like, in a much more solemn, like, I'm the voice of reason type, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's the eyes and, like, the facial expressions that come with it that definitely do justice to all of that.
Yeah, I completely agree. There's so much he does with his facial reactions and the inflection in his voice, and, like, He's playing such an over-the-top character, but he can be so subtle in his approach at times, which is something that I just don't see many other actors being able to do in this role.
Yeah.
All right, so the man of the hour, Mr. Chris Hemsworth himself.
Again, the perfect Thor. Like, he's got the humor, he looks like Thor. Like, I don't think... Like, you can't picture Thor in your head and not picture Chris Hemsworth. So, I think that speaks for itself.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I feel like we've really effectively covered it in our discussion all throughout this episode. But, yeah, I want to reiterate everything you just said, that he, like, Chris Hemsworth just is Thor, and he always will be. I am not saying I am not excited to see Natalie Portman as Jane Foster with the power of Thor, but... Chris Hemsworth has just embodied that role, inhabited that role so fully that I just can't imagine the MCU as a whole without him in that role.
Oh, yeah. And I am most excited to see him in his next roles within Marvel and the Guardians.
Yes.
Because I cannot get enough of his dynamic with Peter Quill. But
yes, very good.
Yeah.
So now I want to ask you, Hagen, where would you rank this film in the within the overall Marvel universe? How does it stack up against other films within the MCU?
I'd say it's pretty average within the MCU.
I am weighted.
I mean, maybe it's on the upper side. I don't know where. I haven't done any like definitive listings or anything. But it's, I mean, for the most part, the big collaborative ones just rank higher because they're bigger. There's more going on. For the most part, Ultron is not like that. and then, you know, there's, it's definitely like, there's nothing I really dislike about the movie. It's probably, I like it more than most of the other origin story movies. But, you know, as like we get on to phase two and three, like there's just more going on. There's more at stake. I'm more invested with the characters. I'm more attached to them by this point. So I'd put it on a solid, like, a little bit on the above average side of things. So like, if we're saying like, you know, 5 out of 10 is like the exact middle of like the 20 something MCU movies, then I'd say it's like a 6 or like a 6.5. But again, that's not like as a movie, like I'm not saying it's a 6 out of 10 movie, right. But I'm saying like, you know, within the Marvel Cinematic Universe, meaning that there are ones and there are tens, I'd mm-hmm. say that it's like a 6.
Okay, that's fair. I also have not made a definitive ranking, which is something that I'm very shocked at myself about. And I'm definitely going to go make a ranking. And I think that we both should by the time we close out Marvel Month, and we should share our rankings on air. But I will say, and again, this is
another hour to do that.
Yeah, literally. This is me. That's just this whole separate episode. We just do an episode of our ranking. And we debate them. But
okay.
I think that, and this is me saying this without like a formal list in front of me, but I really think this would be in my top 10.
Okay, but that's not, see, that's really like, if it's like 8, 9, or 10, that's like just on the cusp of above average though, you know, because there's what, like there's 22, 23 movies that are out.
Yeah, I think there's 23. Yeah,
so yeah,
yeah, we'll see where it ends up ranking. Watch it be like 3. Like, we'll just have to, it won't be, but we'll just wait and see. Keeping you all in suspense. So we mentioned earlier how like the action in this film feels different than other Marvel movies, because the role of the villain is not the standard, you know, we're going to face off against one another 3 times throughout the runtime of this movie, you know, and as it is in most origin stories. So do you appreciate that the encounters with foes are less formulaic in this film than in some other superhero installments? And what do you make of like Loki's role as a villain and Loki's larger role in the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
Yeah, I definitely like that pretty much each battle is a standstill on its own. In that, you know, it creates for the dynamic between all of the different characters and shows where their like allegiances are. So yeah, I don't know. I'm a big fan of it. I think it makes for a bit more unusual type of plot line, and you can't just predict it as well, which I'm always a fan of. I hate when movies are too predictable and you know what the next fight is and you know what's going to happen. So I really like the way they did that and how each fight wasn't just with a different character, but with a character or characters who fight in a different way. And so that you have to have victory in a different way. And having Loki kind of eventually be the overarching mastermind was a good touch, especially because, you know, we all know he's such a diverse character that, again, people want to have a redemption arc. So I really like the way they did that.
Yeah. I agree. And I feel like to have the, you know, payoff of Loki being revealed to be like the big bad in this movie, you have to have the encounters with evil prior to that, like, be less formulaic, because obviously you can't have Loki being the villain from the outset. It just doesn't work. And so I appreciate the fact, like you said, that it's not as predictable, and like, I'm a fan of anything that gives us the ultimate reveal of Loki as the mastermind pulling the strings here.
So. Yeah.
So I wanted us to talk very briefly about a couple things that are less important than the plot and the characterization, but are still things that I think this movie does very, very well. So do you have any thoughts on the closing credits of this movie?
Not particularly. I mean, honestly, I like saw like a couple like segments and then I skipped through to watch the after credit scene.
Mm-hmm. I'm disappointed.
So, but I've never been like one of those people that like I do not sit and like read the credits, you know, like I just chill and talk with the people I was with until the post credit scene rolls around. So,
mm-hmm. Well, I'm a huge nerd, which is a surprise to no one at this point. I mean, I love movie commentaries. I love movie credits. I like to sit. I don't always sit through the entirety of the credits in every movie, but I always sit at least until the names of the assistants to the directors and the top billed actors go by, because I just love that for some reason. It's a very nerdy Kyla specific fun fact. But I really love the closing credits of this film. I think closing credits are things that Marvel always does really well. And when we get to our Endgame episode, I'll probably talk for no joke an hour about those closing credits. Like I think they're the best closing credits ever in cinema. But okay. I like here that they are like fight me, Hagen.
I have no stake in that, so I'll let you have okay. that one.
I'll get my entire argument for why that is the case together by the time we get to our Endgame episode. But I like that these credits map out Yggdrasil, the world's tree, for us, which is something that we've heard Thor describe throughout the movie and Odin describe also. And to finally have like a visual representation of that.
Wait, there's another visual of it. The whole like when they go into the Bifrost and all the thunder, or I mean not the thunder, right. the lightning comes out. That's right. Like,
but to like actually like see it and see like the camera follow it for like an extended period of time. And like okay, to observe okay. like the space in between the different realms and everything. I just think that it's just a genius way to do the credits. And something that Sir Kenneth Branagh revealed in the commentary was that actually was originally intended to be included like within the actual film itself, but it just took too long, so they ended up putting it over the credits. And I want to say that like it was very difficult to get that, because they used like actual like very special technology in order to like have that shot laid out the way that they want. It took 18 months to create, because they based each like individual shot on real images from the Hubble telescope.
18 months.
Wow. just for those credits that you couldn't even sit through, Hagen. Think about that next time you watch Thor.
Okay. So, well, I don't know when the next time will be, but
I'm gonna make you watch it. Like, we're gonna sit down and watch it together. It's going to happen.
If you say so.
And then we're going to watch The Dark World immediately thereafter. And one other thing that I think that this movie does really well, and Hagen is going to fight me on this, but I really think that the poster and the DVD cover of this movie is the best in the MCU thus far. It's so simple, but I love it. It's Thor kneeling with his hammer, and then you have from left to right above him Jane, Loki, Odin, and Heimdall, and their eyes are so vibrant. You have Natalie Portman's brown eyes, Tom Hiddleston's green eyes, Sir Anthony Hopkins' blue eyes, and then of course Idris Elba's edited golden eyes. I love it. I think it's so great. I love looking at that DVD cover, and so I just want to go on record as saying it's the best DVD cover in the MCU.
Okay, but like, you obviously are very partial to it because Natalie Portman is on the cover of an MCU movie.
Okay, but she's way bigger in the Dark World cover, is all I'm going to say. And I prefer the Thor cover. The Dark World cover is like her and Thor like embracing with like thunder clouds around them. But I much prefer this one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, when I searched Thor posters on Google, there was a different poster that I liked better than the one you described. So, and I also just like other Marvel posters in general. I don't know. I like the big mashup ones. Like, I really like Guardians posters. And then I really like, you know, Avengers, Endgame, Infinity War, like even Civil War, like just where the, I like them with more going on, I guess. I mean, there's something to be said about the simplicity of a poster, but I guess for me, my favorites are not following that logic. So this one does not do it for me.
Well, it does it for me, and it is my favorite.
Okay, so, well, good for you. I'm very glad that you have that relationship with the poster.
Thank you. I am too. I appreciate you supporting me.
You're welcome.
So now, again, I want to ask you, how was the experience of rewatching this film in 2020 different from watching it in 2011?
Well, I think the biggest difference is that just I'm a different person. You know, I'm not like as impressionable of a child watching, you know, a superhero movie. But then also, I thought the special effects were actually pretty solid. I thought they held up pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I was impressed with that. I thought the humor, again, was really on point. I'm sure some of the stuff Darcy said, I probably just didn't catch as well before. So that was nice, I guess, to just appreciate the humor.
I did not laugh as hard at the political science, actually, as well.
Yeah, no, definitely that. I don't think I had recognized that before. And the CPR one, too. And then let's see. So yeah, I mean that I thought the humor held up really well. I think, you know, for it being almost a decade later, it held up pretty darn well. So I was impressed. It was nice. It was fun to watch. It wasn't like I knew it was going to happen, but I haven't seen enough times to like have it perfectly memorized. Mm-hmm. So certain like little bits, of course, I didn't really see coming. I just knew like the gist of what was going to happen. And it was good. I enjoyed the rewatch. It wasn't, there's certain movies where I know really well. And if I'm not like in love with it and I rewatch it, it can be hard to sit through because I'm like, okay, I know what's happening. And like, I don't dislike it, but I also don't just like want to necessarily see this conversation that I already know all the words to. You know, right. So this did not have that kind of feel to it. So it was a good rewatch.
Yeah, I agree with you that I think this film holds up really well, probably better than I even like anticipated, because like I said, I watched this movie a lot within like a year or two of it coming out. And then I just kind of, I don't know, didn't watch it for a really long time. And I remember when I returned to it, you know, a few years ago, there almost being like this degree of fear or worry that like it just wasn't going to hold up, because like I had in my brain, it was built up to be like this incredible movie. And I was like, I don't really know if the special effects are going to hold up or, but when I watched it, I absolutely thought that they did. I thought that the production design held up really well. The performances, you know, they're not perfect by any stretch of the imagination, but they get the job done. And so I was pleasantly surprised when I revisited this movie for the first time, like after having been away from it for a while, that overall, like, I think it holds up pretty well. And I think, like you said, that like, because it's one of the earlier Marvel movies, I've encountered it, you know, as a vastly different person during different rewatches. And that's just, you know, always an interesting experience, no matter what the movie. But the fact that like I have somewhat of an emotional attachment to this movie makes each of those experiences all the richer. So
all the richer.
Yeah. So is there anything about this movie that you wanted us to address that we haven't throughout this conversation, Hagen?
I mean, not that I can particularly think of. I think we've covered pretty much everything. I think our runtime is about the same, if not longer, than the movie's runtime now. So,
Well, I'm gonna give you the opportunity to close the show out with a question that I always pose to my guest, which is: Is this a film worth rewatching? Which you've already somewhat addressed, and how would you convince someone of that fact that this is a film worth revisiting?
Well, I think that in general, as a standalone, this is a film that you can enjoy rewatching, especially if you're showing it to someone for the first time. It would be a good, like, entry to Marvel type film. But I think the real selling point for why you would want to rewatch it again is gearing up for just more Marvel in general. You're already a fan, and it's time to do that marathon going through all the movies and get a real appreciation out of the entire story, not just this one snippet. Because on its own, yes, it's good, and yes, I enjoyed the rewatch, but like, I didn't get anything fantastic out of it. You know, I think there's other standalone Marvel movies, and of course other standalone movies, that I would get a lot more out of just a one-time rewatch from. I think if you've only seen this like 10 years ago when you were, again, like we were, a totally different age, and therefore will get a lot out of it, again, that's another great reason to rewatch it. But like, if you've seen it like 3 years ago when you were preparing for like Infinity War or Endgame, then I wouldn't say, hey, take 2 hours out of your day for this particular movie. I would recommend others over it. So that's kind of my wishy-washy take on that.
Mm-hmm. My pitch, obviously, is that Natalie Portman is in this movie, and therefore everyone should rewatch it multiple times. That's it. That's my pitch.
Also, not like, shocked in the slightest. Oh, also, there's more.
You get to look at Chris Hemsworth for 2 hours. It's a win-win.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Are you surprised?
No, not surprised.
Just disappointed.
Did I say it enough in the tone of voice that you knew that word was?
I saw your exact facial like reaction in my head.
The disappointed face.
Exactly. Okay, Hagen, before I can disappoint you further, I'm going to go ahead and officially close the show out. So this has been Play It Again, Kyla. This episode is an installment in our extra special Marvel month. As always, if you have suggestions of films you would like to hear discussed on the podcast, don't hesitate to reach out. You can find the podcast with the handle Play It Again, Kyla on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And you can find me personally at @Kyla_Z_Percival on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd. Once again, this has been Play It Again, Kyla. I am your host, Kyla Percival, signing off and saying, I voted for Andy Kaufman.
You must remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.